Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, I continue my 11-year anniversary special with four more stories from my favorite 11 stories over the last 11 years. The first story is from actress Roxana Ortega. She shares a story about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro.
They wake us up at 12:30 in the pitch black, and we start this ascent up the mountain for 6 hours. Up this icy incline, and they told us it's too high and it's too cold to stop, so we just have to go directly for 6 hours until we get to the top.
And you're going to love this story from actor Larry Clark. He worked as a caterer for Lauren Bacall's party.
She pulls me aside and she goes, "You're pouring too much liquor in the drinks. You're going to get them drunk." And I go, okay, that's a standard. Under my breath, I was like, it's a standard amount. I've made a lot of drinks. But, okay. And then she goes, and put the lids back on the little soda bottle. And she starts doing it in front of me, angrily. This was a good precursor to the rest of the night, because this didn't stop.
And comedian John Reap shares a story about his father's very, very poor decision.
And he buys this underwater repair kit. They have those. And he gets a backpack full of rocks to hold him down at the bottom, you know, so he can fix it but not float to the top, you see, where there's like oxygen and shit.
And then you'll hear from podcaster Jordan Harbinger. He has a heck of a story, and this one is about being kidnapped.
That was my first real red flag where I was like, uh-oh, this guy might not be legit. I'm like, hey, man, just let me out here. Or take me back. No, don't worry. I'm just going to ask for some directions. I'm like, listen, I'll pay you. Just let me out. And then, of course, he gets me with, I thought you didn't have any cash, just a card. And I'm like, damn.
Today on the show, I continue my 11-year anniversary special with stories from actress Roxana Ortega, actor Larry Clark, comedian John Reap, and podcaster Jordan Harbinger. Stay close.
Hey, it's Roxana Ortega.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger.
Hey, this is John Reap.
Hey, Christine, it's Larry Clark. Happy 11-year anniversary of Storyworthy. Fantastic. Congratulations.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show of 11 years, or you're a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, today I'm continuing my anniversary explosion episode with four more stories that absolutely blew my mind. But before we get over to Roxana's story, I wanted to remind you guys to check out the website storysmashshow.com, and that'll give you the latest information of when Story Smash is going to be live next at the Hollywood Improv. And also, follow Story Smash on Instagram at Story Smash, and of course, follow me on all the socials at Storyworthy. All right, you guys, like I said, this first story is from actress Roxana Ortega. Roxana told me this story back in August 2018, and I remember laughing as hard as like my mouth was just hanging open because it's just so funny. And, well, you'll see what I mean. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the very talented Roxana Ortega.
So ever since I was a very little girl, I wanted to go to Africa. I used to come out of my house, and if it was a clear blue sky day, I'd go, "Oh, it's like Africa." And my sisters were like, "No, it's not." Like, it was, I grew up in Orange County in Fullerton, so it was not Africa in any way. But I just had this huge imagination. I would imagine the giraffes and the lions just like roaming against the sky. You know, I was determined to get to Africa. I was already there in my mind, you know. So 5 years ago, a friend of mine, Jenny, not her real name, Jenny said, "Oh, I have nobody to hike Mount Kilimanjaro with." And I was like, "Oh my God, I'll go. I'll hike Mount Kilimanjaro with you, and then we'll do your dream doing that, and then we'll do my dream of going on safari." I thought, you know, this is like an even trade, right? So I knew nothing about Mount Kilimanjaro. She actually had to tell me it was in Africa, at first. It's in Tanzania. And I'm not a hiker, per se. I've been on a few big hikes. It's because I love a good view. And I'm just willing to walk for it, however long, to see, like, the vistas. So I thought, you know, there's probably going to be a lot of walking, but the views are going to be amazing. And she gave me a bunch of books. She gave me, you know, pamphlets and books, all this research she had done. But I didn't want to read too much because I wanted to be surprised. I really like I don't like watching the previews, like, up next, the next episode of whatever. I don't watch them because I like to be surprised. And I stumbled across an interesting fact about Mount Kilimanjaro, that it could kill you, that people died every year, and that we were going to be walking in this extreme altitude, 19,300 feet, for 7 days it was going to take us to get there, and that could cause something called cerebral edema, whose symptoms included two words, brain leak. Brain leak! What? Like, brain leak, okay? So I am very adventurous. I say yes to a lot of things, but I am extremely fearful. Okay, my brain, when I walk down a flight of stairs, I picture my dead body at the bottom of stairs every time. It's just like a reflex my brain does. You know, it pictures itself cracked at the bottom of stairs. So the last thing that it needed was to picture itself leaking on the top of a mountain. Then I get into the gear list. The gear list that our company sent us was 7 pages of essential gear. It was titled Essential Gear, and it was 7 pages. And it had pictures and these words, neoprene sleeve, balaclava, gaiters, like all these words. I grew up in Orange County. Like, I had jean shorts and a bathing suit. You know, I don't know about this winter gear. So I didn't know what they were for, but I knew if I don't get them, I am going to die. And I hadn't planned on doing any sort of training, because I did stumble across in one of the books, you can't train for altitude. And I like clung to that. I was like, great. No, I don't need to train. But I was so freaked out the week before that we left that I started doing Runyon Canyon as if that's proper training, and squatting at the gym, doing all these things I never do. So I get on the airplane to Africa. I'm supposed to meet my friend in Amsterdam. We're meeting up. And I'm on the plane, and I'm convinced I'm going to get thrombosis. You know, like, all my anxieties were coming up. So I start pacing around the plane, and I'm stretching my quads by the bathroom. Like, I just can't sit. You know, I've got to keep my blood moving. No clots. I'm panicking. Okay, I arrive in Tanzania. We get to the base of the mountain. And there's a sign, there's some sign that's like, do not attempt to hike if, you know, and there's like 5 bullet points. I think one of them is like sniffles, you know, I don't know. Like, it's like, if you've had a cold in the last few weeks, you know, if you have congestion, I'm like, oh my God, do I have congestion? I think I have congestion. Do I sound congested? You know, I'm flipping out. Our guides, we meet our 3 guides, 30 porters, and 7 other people we're going to go up the mountain with. And our guides immediately check our heart rate and oxygen levels and, like, log it. So it felt very serious. The first night we're on the mountain, sleeping in our tents. Well, supposed to be sleeping in our tents. Jenny slithers into her little sleeping bag. She falls asleep immediately, right? It's her dream. Her dream trip. I put on all my freaking clothes. I lie there. And I'm just petrified. I'm afraid of the cold. The OC, you know. I'm afraid of the cold. I'm afraid of the wind. It was very windy. And I'm afraid of that brain leak. Like, it's coming up in my head. So the next day, I told our guides all my fears, right? I'm like, oh my God. And they kept saying, don't worry, it's not a problem. Like, that was their go-to response. I was like, no, it's a problem. It feels like a problem to me. I said, I had insomnia, like, I didn't sleep. And one of our guides said, you are tired, so you will sleep. And I was like, no, do you know what insomnia is? Insomnia, no, you're tired and you don't sleep. Do they not have insomnia in Africa? Like, what's going on? And I asked this same guide, I said, how will I know if my brain is leaking? And he said, "You won't know. We will know." I was like, "No, that's horrifying. I won't know? Oh my God." So one of the days that we're walking, the main guide asks, "Who here is afraid of heights?" And I was like, "I am. Oh, I am. I'm afraid of heights. I'm afraid of edges. I'm afraid of falling from heights or edges, all of it." And nobody else raised their hand in the group. And they're like, "Why are you on this trip?" You know, they had no idea. I'm trying to get to my safari, right? The next day, we had to not walk, but scale a wall with all four of our limbs to get up this thing called the Barranco Wall. It's whatever. I did it, okay? But we were walking 7 to 10 hours a day. So you would fall if you didn't have your pole technique down. And I definitely did not have my pole technique down. So I was hitting the ground, just falling. And I kept glaring over at Jenny, like, "Man, your dream is dangerous." You know, just like, just starting to get like resentful. "How did you bring me here?" Right? And finally, we reach the night of the summit attempt, as they say, which they really should rename that night, the summit attempt. And they wake us up at 12:30 in the morning. We're at that point, maybe 15,500 feet. So we tried sleeping at extreme altitude, right? People are really feeling it. They wake us up at 12:30 in the pitch black, and we start this ascent up the mountain for 6 hours up this icy incline. And they told us it's too high and it's too cold to stop. So we just have to go directly for 6 hours until we get to the top, hopefully see the sunrise, and then get back down way lower than 15,000 feet. So because it's so intense for your body. So we start up this mountain. I have all my clothes on. Everybody does. You're assigned your own individual porter to carry all your things. So you just have to worry about getting yourself up. And this porter is in charge of running you down the mountain should anything happen, because at that point you're too high for helicopters to come save you. Machines die there, you know? So we're going up this in the dark, zigzagging up. And about an hour in, someone in our group yells, "Wait!" And she just vomits in the wind. I see it glistening through my headlamp, and then we keep going. An hour more goes. Jenny goes, "Hold on, I have to have diarrhea." Just announces it. She's such a shy person, so you know it was such an intense situation that she would yell that to everybody. And she went behind a rock. She had altitude diarrhea, and then we kept going and going. And an hour more in or so, we're getting closer, and two people in our group say, "It's not worth it." And they just go back down the mountain. They just bail. And a lot of people were bailing. You saw, because every group there's tons of people heading up the mountain. But when we started getting closer and closer, people are turning around. They're going down. It's not worth it. They're scared. They're freaked out. They're sick. And I remember passing this one woman seated. You're not supposed to stop on the mountain, but she was seated in the icy ground, and her eyes were bugged out, and she was breathing so fast. Like it reminded me of the end of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where they rip that guy's heart out, and he's like, and we passed her. We're like, "Okay, good luck to you." And we just kept going. And I somehow was doing surprisingly well, you know, after all the stink I was making, I was doing well. I mean, I was felt strong and determined and focused. And I remember thinking, like, "This is crazy. Like, what are you doing? You don't even want to do this. This isn't your dream. This is Jenny's dream. Like, all you want to do is be on safari, sitting in a Jeep. They don't even allow you to walk. And here you are trying to like reach the summit and make it to the peak." But as I was walking in the dark, like I realized, oh, that's not what this is about for me. I felt like I was walking towards every anxiety that I had ever had in my life. I felt like I was facing myself, facing like my nature, the thing that, you know, I try to reconcile with all the time, my mortality. Like it felt that big. And I was thinking about my dad who had died just the year before. And I knew he wouldn't want me to stop walking. And I kept thinking about my life and what I wanted it to be about. And I knew I didn't want to be that girl that turned around on the mountain. So at 6:30 in the morning, we made it. We made it to the summit. And the sun was, you know, rising. And we laughed, we cried, and I was like, I need to pee! That was the first words out of my mouth, and I peed behind a tiny rock in front of tons of people. And the views were amazing, I must say. I'm not sure it was worth the walk, but the views were like being on Mars. Like, they were otherworldly up there. But the coolest thing was I somehow felt like I had climbed to a higher place inside of myself. Like, I could have died, but I didn't. I somehow summited over all those fears, right? I didn't die. And that made my safari even more blissful. We went on that safari, and I literally burst into song. I've never been happier in my life. Like, I was so happy to be there. I watched all the animals, you know, roaming around and was drinking every African beer I could get my hands on. And it was bliss, pure bliss. But it was more blissful because I had hiked that mountain. And I always remember that.
All right. Was that a great story or what? I'm telling you, Roxana is so talented. You guys can find her over at RoxanaOrtega.com. And yeah, just a great talent. All right, you guys, the next story is coming from actor Larry Clark, and he told me this story in August of 2019. Larry Clark is so talented. He's an actor and a writer, and he lived in New York for quite a while, and this story takes place there. So wherever you are, put your hands together for Larry Clark.
You know, this is a hard story to tell because it was not a good experience. I learned a lot about celebrity. I learned a lot about Hollywood. This was in the early 90s. I was working at a restaurant called Tattoo in New York City, so I was waiting on a lot of... It was a very she-she, happening, hip joint. I was being exposed to a lot of celebrities and B-celebrities every single day. This guy who tended the bar there, Michael Jordan, he said, "Hey, Larry, I got this thing for you if you want to do it." He goes, My wife works for Lauren Bacall. She's her assistant. And they need a waiter to run a Christmas party for her. He says, "And I thought about you because you're not going to get paid well at all. As a matter of fact, she's really cheap." He goes, "But you're going to get a good story out of it." He goes, "Because there's going to be some other celebrities there, and you're the only waiter." I went, "Absolutely. Sign me up." "Where is it?" He goes, "It's in the Dakotas." I was like, "I love the Dakotas." I was obsessed with the Dakotas because of John Lennon.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the early 90s, blah, blah, blah. That's 10 years after he was shot. And anyway, I was always wanted to get into the Dakotas. And so this was my opportunity. And I wasn't that crazy about Lauren Bacall, but I was like, this is going to be interesting. So he did warn me. He goes, "Listen, it's a Christmas party. She's cheap as hell. They're going to pay you. Right before you get there, you're going to get an envelope for $75. I said, $75? I mean, I was also working with Glorious Food at the time, which was a high-end catering company. And I was making, you know, $17 an hour. But on Christmas parties, you would make double that. In other words, you would always get tipped pretty heavily at Christmas time. And this was Christmas. This was like December 18th. He was like, "Yeah, that's not going to happen." So I was like, "Whatever. You know, this isn't for the money. I will go." So he set it up. He gave me the parameters. I walked up to the Dakotas. I walked right in. I could not believe it. I was so excited. And the guy was like, you know, I expected a lot more like, hey, who are you? And, you know, show you. I said, I'm here for Lauren Bacall. And he goes, hey, go up, go straight on. He was like, he didn't ask for any like identification. But he did say, take the back stairs. And then I realized that the back stairs are the servant stairs. So, you know, with your help, if you're anyone, you're going into these luxurious homes at the Dakota, if you're servicing the owners, you go through the elevators in the back. You don't go in the elevators in the front, which is whatever. But it's something to be noted. So I took it to, like, what, the fifth floor, got out, and I was like, you know, psyched. And I knocked on the door, and it started. And it did not stop for 3 hours. She whipped the door up, and she went, are you Larry? You're late. And I was like, what do you mean? I said, it's 7:15. It's an 8 o'clock party. He goes, it's 7:30. And I was like, okay. And she goes, oh, hell, come in. And then, like, put your stuff down. And she was crazy. And I walked into this amazing – they sold this this apartment recently, I think, for $28 million.
Oh, my God.
It had, like, 20-feet ceilings, an unbelievable number of rooms. It was filled with artifacts and art. I mean, it was unbelievable. She walked into this whole other world. I was like, what is this place? And she was like, light the fires, Larry, light the fires. I was like, okay, what fires? Where are they? Over there, Larry. And so I said, light fires, okay. I was like, I was totally, I got that she was going to be eccentric, and I was totally in for this. I was going to keep my temper, and everything's going to be fine. So I start lighting the fire, and then I was like reaching for something, and it dropped, and she went, oh my God, what did you do? And it was like the door slid open, and, you know, some books fell or something. And I went, oh, sorry about that. And she goes, good, right there. And all of a sudden, ding dong, she went, get the door, Larry. And I was like, is there anybody else here? And he goes, no. He goes, get the door, take their coats. And I was prepped that she had not had a party in years, that she has basically, you know, been very unsocial for whatever reason. That's what I was told. So she was nervous about this. So who was being invited were Anthony Hopkins, Natasha Richardson, Liam Neeson, the Schlesingers. Arthur Schlesinger was coming, and then another couple I didn't quite know. They were pretty big in the business world. And that's it. So it was a party of about, you know, 9 people, 10 people.
Like a dinner party, really.
It was a dinner party, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I wanted to meet Anthony Hopkins big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, Remains of the Day was in the theater. You know, I had seen Remains of the Day, and I was like blown away. I'd like seen it the week before. And so I was just like, anyway, I opened the door, and there he is. He's like the first to arrive. He's like, hello, hi, how are you? My name's Tony. And I go, hi, ma. And she goes, oh, hello, Tony, how are you? Take his coat. And I took his coat, and she hasn't told me. I haven't prepped anything for this party. I don't know where anything is. I'm holding the coat, and she's like, over there. Like, I can see her, like, pointing with her head. Over there. So I go, yes, thank you. And I put the coat down, ding dong. And another door, then all of a sudden everyone's coming in. I'm taking coats. And she goes, get him drinks, Larry. And I go, yes, what would you like, Mr. Arnold? He goes, Diet Coke. Okay, got a Diet Coke for him. And then everyone kind of like went into the front room. And she was like, basically, this is a long story. So I got to kind of do the Reader's Digest version because it's unbelievable the way that things transpired. And how I connected with her. She was obsessed with me during this whole party. She kept her eyes on me constantly. And we hadn't really talked before. You know what I mean? So I didn't have any prep. So she was trying to teach me or guide me or something. And it looked like she hadn't had many parties, truly. So she was like, so we all went to the first room. And everyone pretty much arrived, and she was like, make drinks. And I asked everyone for drinks, and I started making them, and I could see her looking at me as I was – it was a little tiny little drink table. I'll never forget it. And it had little tiny soda bottles, and I'm making like little gin and tonics and like that, and she's staring at me. And so we stayed there for about 10 minutes, and we moved to the – shall we go to the next room? She said, ha, ha, ha. And again, she's like laughing for everyone else and looking at me kind of leering. So I got that right away. I was like, why is she treating me like this? You know, like, I've just got here. I'm a good guy.
How old were you at the time?
This was in the early 90s, so I'm like around 33, 32. Yeah.
So maybe she's into you.
She's not into me at all. No, not into me at all.
Okay.
No, she's leering at me. She's trying to speak to me with her eyes. So anyway, we go to the next They move to the next room. She pulls me aside and she goes, "You're pouring too much liquor in the drinks. You're going to get them drunk." And I go, oh, okay. That's a standard. Under my breath, I was like, it's a standard amount. I've made a lot of drinks. But okay. And then she goes, "And put put the lids back on the little soda bottle." And she starts doing it in front of me, angrily. And these little tiny little pony soda and tonics. And I'm like, I'm literally looking at her like, I have so much to do. And I go, am I literally going to be watching you do, like, make this point about pony bottles? This was a good precursor to the rest of the night, because this didn't stop. Okay, so we go to the next part. She goes, get the wine, more wine. And, Anthony Hopkins was unbelievably nice. He would look you in the eye. He treated me like an equal. And Liam Neeson was incredibly gracious. You know, I didn't really know. He wasn't that big then, but he was just becoming a star. And Natasha was gorgeous. Yeah. And they were chain-smoking Marlboros and drinking tons of red wine. They all drank. She goes, "Go get the appetizers." And I don't know, she's whispering under my breath, "I'll be right back." And I go back there, and she had her woman that obviously works there every day. You know, she was Mexican and didn't speak much English. And I tried to get some stuff out of here. I couldn't get anything. I was like, what do I do? She just handed me this tray, and I go out there and I give her the appetizers. And then she like pulls me aside. She's like, "What are you doing?" You know, she was giving me this little private thing, like I'm fucking up. And I go, "I don't know what are you talking about?" She goes, "No, just we're going to go to dinner soon. Just stay on it." And I go, "Okay, all right." And by then, this feeling of being like starstruck starts to leave. Yeah. And now I start getting pissed off. I've waited on a lot of celebrities. Yeah. And I had been in, working on the Upper West Side for a while, since 1988. So I'd been there for 4 or 5 years, and all I did was wait on kind of people who, you know, and generally they were all pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then again, I was working at Tattoo. So, but she was starting to piss me off. I was like, "You kind of don't talk to me this way, you know?" And
it's like she needs you.
Yeah, you do need me to pull off this party. Why are you making me nervous? Right. And now, why are you pissing me off? She came outside. She went, she goes, "Use these glasses over here for the wine." She goes, "These are bogey glasses. They're for our wedding." She goes, "The Tiffany." She goes, "Don't break them. Don't break them." Like, and in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to break them. But I'm like, why are we using these frickin' Tiffany glasses then? I'm nervous as hell, passing these things out, pouring wine in them. And then they all went and had dinner. And it was like a buffet-style dinner. And I literally started sweating and having a bit of a panic attack during all this because literally I thought this, "Oh my God, I'm getting so angry, I can't control it." So I had to I left the room and I called my girlfriend at the time. And I was like, I told her, "I'm going to leave. I'm just going to walk. I'm going to walk. I'm getting paid $75 and this woman's treating me like crap." And she goes, "Hang in there." She kind of talked me down. I go, "This is unbelievable." I said, "I want to take these bogey glasses. I'm going to just smash them on the floor." She goes, "No, just hang in there." So, where am I in the story? So they had dinner. And then at one time during dinner, she and I was kind of hiding in the back room. Because now I thought about, every time I come out, I'm having this weird interaction with her. I'm going to stay away. Like, I'm just going to hang out. They all got their main course. I'm going to stay away. Yeah. And she went, "Where is he?" I hear her echoing down the hall. She goes, "Where is he? Where is the boy?" She called me, "Boy, boy," like that, like barked it. And I went, "Boy, boy." She says, "Where's the boy? I'm not a boy." And that's where that slave feeling started to kind of kick in. And everything started kind of, the way she had treated me with every moment leading up to that, now I was pissed. And I was, every moment, probably I stayed there for another hour until the end of the party, but I could have left every 5 minutes. I was like, "Should I leave? No, I'm going to stay." But now I'm pissed. She went, "Larry," she goes, take the coffee orders. And I went, "Okay, I'll be right back." And I went to the kitchen, and they had set up this huge classic, coffee and tea service had been set up with these, very expensive china you know, coffee and tea glasses, and you know, this huge, you know, what is it called?
Decanter.
A huge coffee decanter. Yes, and it's all glorious, and it's on this big silver tray. I picked it up, and it's heavy as hell. And I start walking it down, and in my head, I'm thinking, you know, I know what she wants me to do. She wants me to stay in that little room. They were in a little tiny room, and she wants me to pour coffee for everybody. And what would you like? Coffee, cream, and then you pour 10 cups of coffee. Already I'm sweating, I'm angry, and I'm in my head, I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to do this. There's no way I'm going to do this. So as I'm walking down the hall, Anthony Hopkins is walking the other way towards me. And I'm walking with the silver tray, and I just seen Remains of the Day, and it's just he and I. And he walks straight towards me, and in my head I'm like, I am you. I just felt like saying, I'm an actor. I'm an actor. I am you. And I just watched you. And I'm more than this. I'm more than this. I wanted to say it. And he went, excuse me, where are the bathrooms? And I was like, down the hall. Down the hall, Mr. Sir Anthony. Oh, God. Look at me. I'm always going to be a waiter. I'm always going to be this. I'm tragic, just like in your movie. My life's going to be a tragedy. I'll never do what I want to do. So anyway, I walked all the way down. Like, there she was. I put it right, that coffee service, right in front of Lauren Bacall. And as she went, Larry, like basically like, Larry, and I just went, turned, and I walked. And went, Larry, Larry, and I just walked away. Walked away. And then I stayed away for the rest of the party. And they all like finished their coffee, made coffee themselves. Oh, I'm sorry, this is America. Oh, you got to make your own coffee. I'm sorry if I didn't, serve you correctly. And then they left, and she laid into me. And she said, I don't know where you think you've done this before, or why you even think you qualify as a professional. And I stopped her and I said, listen, I said, I am a professional. I work for one of the best catering companies in America, Glorious Foods. I've been in the service industry now for the last 15 years. I know exactly what I'm doing. And you should have called me in an hour earlier and we could have gone over this party. And I needed an assistant because your place is so damn big. I said, but you didn't do that, did you? She goes, what? And I totally gave it back to her. And she's like, well, I was told that you were a professional. I said, again, I am a professional, but I should have had a captain on this party. And you didn't want to spend the money. You didn't want to do that. So that's fine. But I can only do so much. Now I'm going to, you know, clean up. And it was interesting. When I gave that little bark back at her, it shut her up. And she got this like little smile on her face, almost like she enjoyed it. And that kind of like rat-a-tat-tat back and forth kind of continued. And then she started asking me about what I did. She started opening up in a way. She was, so you're an actor, you know. She kind of opened up on that a little bit, and she told me a couple of bogey stories. Then it was just her and I. The guests have left. I mean, the workers left. It was just her and I in this huge place. But the whole tenor of the night changed. And now, somehow in all this, I'd gotten her respect.
Yeah.
And now my view of her had changed. So now I thought, you know what it was? I got through it. Whatever it is, I told her, you don't treat me this way. And she was like, he's right. You know, I could see I landed on her. And all of a sudden, she wasn't just looking at a worker. She was looking at a human being. Mm-hmm. And an actor, you know, or whatever I wanted to be. I was standing there strong, and I was not going to acquiesce to her. And I didn't care whether she was a celebrity or not. And I think ultimately that got through to her. And I just remember us finishing up the dishes, and I was cleaning those bogey glasses, and she started telling me stories. And then we were done, and it was a little awkward. Like, all of a sudden, we were like, oh. There was a little bit of tension. I wouldn't say it was sexual tension, but it was a little bit like, okay, well, time to go. You know, it was that little moment. And then we had this this thing at the end where I went to back to the – of course, she didn't let me leave in the front entrance. I had to leave during, you know, in the back servant entrance. She took me to the back door, and she went, that's it. And I go, I forget, where is the elevator? And she went, well, you go to the left, take another left, and there's the elevator. She goes, you press the button, and when the door opens, you get in. That's what she said to me. And as she was saying it to me, she was like in her back door. I remember the light was kind of hitting her from behind, and it darkened her face, and you know, I was kind of shocked when I first met her how much she had aged, you know, because we didn't have internet then. You know, we hadn't seen a lot of pictures of people aging. So she wasn't striking Lauren Bacall anymore, you know, during the whole party. I was like, wow, this woman's gotten older. She's obviously in her late 60s or whatever she was. But somehow in that moment, with the light from behind, I saw the beauty of her silhouette and I saw her style. And then immediately I thought about her most famous line, which was, whistle? You ever heard, remember that? It's from one of those movies that you haven't seen. It's her famous line is, they go, how do you whistle? And she goes, well, you put your lips together and you blow.
Yeah.
Right? So, but it almost had that kind of a sexy kind of a feel to it when she was telling me to go to the elevator. And for a second, I just looked at her and went, wow, I can see it. I see it now. This is a sexy, powerful woman.
Wow.
At the same time, I thought to myself, she's very alone. I was leaving her alone in this mansion of an apartment, and that you could tell that she had not had a lot of parties. She wasn't going to have anyone over for a long time after this, and that she really was alone. I made a note to myself. I'm not impressed with that with celebrity. Like my career, I want to be surrounded by people and joy and love and a family. And I would never have that feeling. I didn't want to be around that. I wasn't impressed with that. That scared me. So anyway, I left and I got a story out of it.
Wow.
And there you go.
You got a great story out of it.
Is that funny or what, you guys? Larry does the best imitations. He cracks me up. And you guys should follow him over there on Twitter at @LarryClark_. Larry Clark with an E on the end, _. All right, you guys, the next story coming up is just outrageous. I think you're going to hear me laughing the whole way through. It's from comedian John Reap, and he told me this story way back in October of 2015. And it's just about his upbringing and his dad and some very bad decisions. Wherever you are, you guys, put your hands together for the very talented John Reap.
Well, my worthy story is the time where my dad almost drowned trying to fix a hole in the bottom of our swimming pool by wearing a backpack full of rocks and trying to breathe through a garden hose. Yeah. Well, first of all, you might be thinking, you hear the accent, and you're probably thinking, well, swimming pool in the backyard, that's got to be above ground. No. It's a valid thought in your head, but it is not true. My parents are okay. We had an in-ground pool in the backyard. Had a deep end, had a shallow end. It was the kind that had the lining in it. And one day, not the cement kind, actually had the lining, you know. And the lining got ripped at the very bottom of the deep end. And he had to fix it himself, which was fine. But he could have easily let all the water drain out first. But that would have been simple, safe, and efficient. He's like, so he goes out and he buys this underwater repair kit. They have those. And he gets a backpack full of rocks to hold him down at the bottom, you know, so he can fix it, but not float to the top, you see, where there's like oxygen and shit. And then he's going to use a garden hose to breathe through. And I wish you could have seen this, because there was a moment where he was actually like hanging on the side of the pool in the deep end. Okay. He's got a backpack full of rocks on his back. There is a garden hose coming out of his mouth. There's duct tape everywhere. No leaks here. And he's hanging on the side of that pool. And he started thinking, this is pretty stupid. But it was too late. He was locked in. And he gave me and my brother a quick little speech. And our job was to just stand there and hold the hose for him at the top. 2 8- and 9-year-olds just stand there in charge of their father's life. And he's hanging on this thing like, all right, listen here. This is important. If you two boys feel your daddy tugging on this hose, that means abort mission and pull my ass back up. So he goes underwater. He's down there. I give him 10 seconds. And, of course, the water pressure, or maybe the fact that his lungs are not strong enough to pull air under 9 feet of water, one of those two, I don't know, prevented him from breathing. And so he you know, he's freaking out. He starts tugging on the hose, and me and my brother were ready, but we panicked because we're just kids, and we just yanked it as hard as we could, and it flew out of his mouth and all the way out of the pool. So now we're standing above with this hose in our hands. He's down there with no lifeline. We don't know what to do. We're trying to get the hose to go back underwater, but it doesn't work like that. You can't get a hose to go back underwater because it'll snake up on you, right? So you actually would have to jump in there and take it to him. But then that brings water in the hose. So it's almost impossible. So he's down there freaking out. He's waving his hands. He can't get the backpack off. There's way too much duct tape. He's ripping off chest hair underwater. Me and my brother, he's like waving, and we're waving back like, what do we do? And so he decides the only way out of this problem is he's got to make a run for it to the shallow end, up the slope. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody actually try to sprint underwater with a sack of rocks on their back. It's quite comical, kind of, you know, because he'd get about halfway up a slope, and he's running, like, he's sprinting, but he's not going anywhere. He's hauling ass, but he's going nowhere. And, like, he'd get about halfway up the slope and then hit a patch of algae and then go back down. You know, we didn't think he was going to make it, but he finally made it somehow, thank God. He just walked right up. All the way, just walked up to the shallow end. And that was weird, too, because as we're watching this, he is staring at us underwater, screaming like he's pissed. And he gets bubbles that are following him. He comes up out of water with his eyes already open. Like, that's creepy in itself. Most people have their eyes shut and come out and do stuff. This one, his eyes were open, and he was staring at us, and he was screaming. And he just came up out of water, and he's like, hey, come here! Both of you, right now! What the hell? Didn't you two idiots see your daddy down there waving for help? We're like, we just thought you was waving, daddy. What's an idiot? So luckily he survived that and to go on to do many, many other dumb things that are now in my act.
Was that funny or what? Come on. John Reap's dad with a backpack of rocks in a pool. What is happening? I love that story. You guys find out more about John Reap over at his website, johnreap.com. He's so great. And he also has a really good Instagram feed. So check that out too. All right, you guys, the final story of my 11-year anniversary extravaganza part two comes to us from Jordan Harbinger. Now, Jordan Harbinger has a very popular show called The Jordan Harbinger Show that is very intelligent. That's what it is. It's intelligent. He's talked to everybody from Oliver Stone to Malcolm Gladwell and a lot of other thought leaders. He is a really interesting guy himself. You'll hear when he tells you this story that is titled Kidnapped. So yeah, get ready. And Jordan shared this with me in 2013. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Jordan Harbinger.
So I'm in Mexico City and I'm doing this nonprofit work, which is actually just kind of a load of crap because this is how I got the job. I emailed an email address in cyberspace when the World Wide Web was probably like black and white and you had, you know, click things using like the keyboard to highlight it. And they're like, sure, come on down and you can have a job in our office. So I flew down there. That should have been my first clue. I flew down there and I started doing air quotes work with this nonprofit exchange student organization that I had gone to Germany with a few years prior. And they had nothing for me to do whatsoever. When I asked when I should show up to the office, they said, whenever. And I was like, 9, 10, 11. They were like, sure. If I got there before 11 a.m. at any time, there was never anyone there. And after about 2:33 p.m., there was never anyone there. And when I got there, I basically didn't do anything. They wouldn't let me clean anything because that was someone else's job, but I also couldn't email or I had no purpose whatsoever. So I started just making friends with random people. And there's another guy there who was a German guy who's about my age. And we lived in the same place for a while. And then we got separated. And I ended up sleeping on a rooftop in like a barrio, which is like a neighborhood in the middle of nowhere on the outside of Mexico City. And one day we decided – this is in the year 2000 or so. So nobody had mobile phones really. There wasn't a whole lot of communication. So we decided we were going to meet at some bar that we saw in a book – in the middle of town, and we're going to do that around 9:30. So I dress up in my finest cool guy Banana Republic chinos and like button down or whatever because we're going to hit the town, and I stand outside my rooftop area where I decide, all right, I have two transportation options. There's these old school buses painted with like giant murals of Mariah Carey in airbrush that like take 3 hours to get you anywhere because they stop on every block picking up all the old Mexican ladies. Or I can just suck it up and take a cab. And I thought, all right, I don't need to sweat for the next 45 minutes on my way to this bar, so I'm going to take a taxi. So I flagged down a cab. And like any good idiot tourist who's 20 years old, the first thing I say is, hey man, I don't have any cash. All I have is a credit card, so I need to go to the ATM before you drop me off. And he says, no problem. So Mexico City, if you've ever been there, is like a bowl shape in that the center of town is in the middle and all of the crappy areas are on the outside and on these mountains. And I was pretty high up, but not all the way up. And if you go towards the city, towards the light in the center, that's when you know you're going towards downtown. So we started going around the edge of the bowl a little bit. And I'm like, all right, whatever. Maybe there's some traffic or something, or maybe he knows a different way. And after a while, I'm like, hey, man, what's going on here? And he's like, oh, I just need some directions. And that was the first red flag, because getting directions to the center of town in Mexico City is like being in Washington, D.C. and being like, take me to the White House. And the cabbie's like, geez, where's that? Let me ask somebody. I mean, it's not going to happen. So that was my first real red flag where I was like, uh-oh. This guy might not be legit. And so I'm driving, and I'm like, hey, man, just let me out here. Or take me back. No, don't worry. I'm just going to ask for some directions. I'm like, listen, I'll pay you. Just let me out. And then, of course, he gets me with, I thought you didn't have any cash, just a card. And I'm like, damn, because I didn't have any cash, and my plan was to just get out of the cab and then, like, figure it out or just not pay and be like, whatever, dude, see you later. But that didn't work. So he wouldn't stop, and then we kept driving. Meanwhile, I'm like freaking out, thinking like, at what speed do I tuck and roll and like dive out of this car, moving car? And he stops in front of this like really crappy cinder block building that looks real sketch, and like it's really dark. We're on like a dirt-ish road that was like paved one time and has been ground into gravel. And I'm like, don't get out of the cab. Meanwhile, I was seated behind the driver diagonally, and I'd since slid to sitting right behind him because I was like, I need to be able to sort of control the situation a little bit more. And when I was 20, I was actually bigger than I am now. I was about 209 pounds, so I was about 30 pounds heavier than I am right now. I'm 180, and I'm not that small at 5'10", 180. So I was 30 pounds heavier than I am now. You can see the picture on the website if you need a visual. And it was mostly muscle. I was mostly working out all day because I had nothing else to do. And so he said, listen, I'm just going to ask for directions. We're at my friend's house. Let me out. I'll be right back. And I said, don't get out of the cab. And I put my arm between the driver and the door. He didn't see that. He was maybe late 40s, early 50s. He didn't see that. So he said, okay, relax. This is all in Spanish, so I'm paraphrasing here. That's when he makes a fast one to go for the door. And a little struggle ensues. And I mean little because he was probably like 140 pounds. So I had like 80 pounds-ish, 70 pounds on this guy. And he couldn't get past my arm. At first, he didn't know why, because he was trying to, he had the handle and he was pushing, but I kept throwing him back into his chair. And I realized, you know, if anyone is in this house or anybody knows who this guy is, they're going to start to get a feeling that something's wrong here, or he's going to hit the horn or whatever, or start screaming. So I reached up and I grabbed the back of the seat. I pushed, rather, the back of the seat with my chest, and I reached around the seat with both arms, and I put a death grip on this guy's neck until he stopped moving. And that didn't take very long. It only took a few seconds. And he was just, he couldn't do anything. He was flailing around, whatever. And so I got out of the cab, and it took me a while because the locks were broken, or maybe they were rigged that way. I don't know. So I opened his door from the inside. I take him and I throw him out of the cab, and I try to drive his car, but it's a stick. And at this point, I'm freaking out, and I can't really remember how to drive a stick shift vehicle. Plus, it's got like a sticky clutch, and I'm like, okay, to hell with this crap. I don't know how to get out of here. So I took the keys out of the ignition and I chucked him into the dark. I should have probably kept those in my hand, but I chucked him in the dark. Meanwhile, he's not moving. He's on the sidewalk, or what might be called a sidewalk. And I'm looking around. There's no one around. No one seems to have heard anything. And he wasn't screaming, because by the time I'd even opened the doors to the car, he was already out. So I laid him down. I pulled his body into a shadow, and I just hauled ass back in the direction we came. I probably ran I don't even know. It might have been half a mile. It might have been a mile. I mean, at this point, you're not really measuring. No one would stop for me, not surprisingly, because here I am, like, wearing Banana Republic crap, like, chinos and, like, a button-down, like a purple button-down or blue or something, probably soaked through with sweat. And I'm, you know, a bigger dude at that point compared to the average, like, rural or outsized suburban Mexican from Mexico City. And I have bleach blonde hair because I'm 20 and I'm an idiot. And I'm, like, just gasping for air, like, dripping sweat in the middle of this probably crappy area that I'd been driven to. No one would stop on the last main road when I finally got there. Finally, an older guy stops. There's a younger woman in the car who I assumed was his daughter, but in retrospect, looking at Mexican society, very well could have been his girlfriend or wife. And she's like, well, we can't just leave him here. And it turns out that he was a doctor, and he's like, are you injured? I said, no, but I've been kidnapped. I don't know where I am. And they said, who kidnapped you? All I could say was a taxi driver. And at that point, they kind of like had this look in their face like, oh, that's a thing that happens. Or like, okay, he's probably not lying. And I was like, I don't know where I am. And so she's like, you can't leave him here. I'm like, please, I don't know if they're behind me. Like, I don't understand what's going on. Like, and they looked, you know, they're looking around. There's no one around. No one had chased me as far as they could see and as far as I could see. So I got in the backseat of the car. And they drove me to a metro station and just let me go. And I was like, and in the car, I'm freaking. I'm like, I need to go to the cops to take me to the police station. And they said, that's when they explained. They said, listen, don't go to the cops. If you know what's good for you, do not go to the cops, because they probably will come and get you and bring you right back here. And that's sort of when I had this rude awakening where I was like, holy crap, the Mexican police are just as integrated with this crime as like the criminals themselves. So they said it may or may not happen, but the last thing you want is for the cops to call this guy and be like, we found the guy that escaped and possibly killed the cab driver that brought him there, or whatever happened to that guy. And so I thought, okay, I'm done. I immediately packed up my stuff and got the hell out of there like the next day. I slept over on my roof because I was in a little bit of shock, and then I packed my crap and I moved the day after.
Was that good? Huh? What did I tell you? You guys can find out a lot more about Jordan over at his website, jordanharbinger.com. All right, you guys, thank you again so much for tuning in and listening to Storyworthy. You know, I have a new network called Podcast One, and I would be thrilled if you'd go over to Podcast One and subscribe to the show over there. But of course, you can listen wherever you want. You know, it's everywhere. And you can follow me all over the social media at Storyworthy, and you can even email me. How about that? You want to email? ChristineBlackburn1@gmail.com. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of my very talented guests today, Roxana Ortega, Larry Clark, John Reap, and Jordan Harbinger. My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.